Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that explores the people, the stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm Greta Anderson.
And I'm Stephanie Schubert, and we are your hosts for the day.
When we came to work at Iowa State about 20 years ago, one of the things that I noticed was that all of our secretaries live outside of Ames because they really couldn't afford to live in Ames.
A single mother working minimum wage has to work 79 hours a week to afford what's called the fair market rent in Ames.
If we continue to see the kind of growth in enrollment or experience consistent enrollment like this, we need to provide more housing on campus.
What we hear from the companies coming in from out of town is if they're going to come and they want to develop their business right here in Ames, they want their employees here in Ames. And they're saying that they're finding it harder and harder that we have enough housing of all different kinds, low to, you know, more expensive.
Every community should simply have it etched in stone if necessary, so don't forget it, that the range of housing in their community should reflect the range of incomes. So that people, if they're good enough to work here, they're good enough to live here.
The topic of today's show is the scarcity of housing in Ames, particularly affordable housing. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are 10 million working poor in the U.S., and some of them work in Ames. Added to that national trend, the rapidly growing enrollment in ISU has put a lot of pressure on Ames' rental housing market.
Later in the show, Greta talks to ISU Director of Residence Pete England about increasing enrollment numbers and how he is going to house them all.
Even the Chamber of Commerce of Ames has something to say on this topic. We'll listen to that later. But I thought we'd start with Vic Moss, Director of Emergency Residence Project.
Full disclosure, one of your hosts is on the board of the Emergency Residence Project.
That would be me.
The Emergency Residence Project is another word for a shelter.
It's a shelter, but we also have six transitional housing units where families can stay up to a year. And we have a homelessness prevention program where we keep people in their housing by paying little bits of their bills.
And where is it exactly?
There's a main shelter on South Kellogg Street. And then on either side are the transitional housing units. And then during the day, on certain days, people who are in need of emergency assistance with bills come and apply for that money. They have to not have asked for it within the past year, so we're just there for emergency.
So this is an important issue for you.
It really is. So we could call this day's show advocacy journalism, because as a member of the board, I've been sitting in on these meetings. We'll start out talking about some little issue about the board's management, and then before we know it, we are launching into a discussion of low wages, transportation issues. Everything is so intertwined. And Vic, our fearless leader, is very much, you know, a prophet waging against the tyranny of this system of poverty, keeping people at the brink of homelessness. You know, these are not people who all make perfect choices, and I don't think any of us could be said to have perfect records as far as our choices go, but it's a systemic problem. And when I say that he's like an Old Testament prophet, I really mean that he constantly wants us to speak to our community about our community's values. Are we living according to our values? Is it part of our values to put kids out on the street? These are the kinds of things you're going to be hearing from him. And
wow,
it's what he does. It's very powerful. So that's why I've gotten so involved, really.
Okay.
And others, too. There are others on the board who have gotten very involved.
So you describe some organizations in your interviews. HUD is mentioned. AMOS is mentioned. Can you describe briefly what those are?
HUD is the Department of Housing and Urban Development. They administer the money that Congress appropriates for housing assistance. So the major program that HUD administers is the Section 8 program, which is housing assistance for quote unquote needy individuals, those who are disabled, the elderly, people with young children who can't get jobs. So in the Section 8 program, a family can get their housing for 30% of their income. So if their income is zero, they pay zero, and the government will pay the rest of the rent. If the family makes $1,000, then $300 of that will go toward their rent, and the federal government will make up for the rest of it.
Well, I would love to hear an Old Testament prophet.
Well, Vic starts out this interview at the end of a long day. So he starts out a little world-weary, and as we go along, and we'll be airing other parts of the interview later in the show, the Old Testament prophet really comes out. So here's Vic Moss. Well, Vic, we seem to talk with you very frequently, but it's really because one of the biggest stories we think in Ames is the lack of affordable housing. What kind of anecdotes can you tell us about the situation on the ground as you see it?
Well, I could start with today. In the other room there, I've got a card with it. I've been writing down names of families and numbers and stuff. We were full when we began the day. And it turns out that we have a possibility of using two rooms at an older motel, and that's really our quota, because we already have five people put up in motel rooms. And so a family called. They're on their way here now, as far as I know. They've been calling every day, you know. And anyway, we have to reserve one room for them, which leaves four more families that need spots, and at most I'll get one more in. So I know at least two families will be on the street tonight, you know, unless a miracle happens. There was a time not that many years ago when we were able to house almost everybody that came to us at least for a while, generally for 2 weeks. It was kind of our limit at that time. We were leasing rooms at the motels, and we were pretty much able to keep up with the demand, you might say. Now, after the 2 weeks, that doesn't mean that we were solving their problem, because oftentimes they still needed another place to go, but we could at least buy time for almost everybody that came here, and now we can't even buy that time. You know, some families, they're just trying to get a night. Most of them need permanent affordable housing, though, and we can't find it. We talked to the providers, an agency called Surha in Grimes, Iowa, down near Des Moines, and then we have a housing project called Eastwood here in Ames, and we talk with them all the time, and their waiting lists right now are a year or more, and it looks like they're going to keep creeping longer and longer. And that's the problem. A lot of families that we refer to the affordable housing run through HUD, I'd say probably more than half, and maybe it's even a much larger percentage, are immediately ruled ineligible before they even, you know, their foot in the door, because they look at their past rental history, their credit histories, they do a background check, and often they'll check with the past two or three landlords. It's usually that credit check that tips them up, because they'll do the credit check and find out that they left a lease early, maybe two or three years ago, and the landlord goes and gets a judgment. You know, they can garnish their wages if they discover they're working. And so here's a judgment. It can be $8,000 because they left a lease after a few months, and yet they have to pay the $800 a month rent for the entire year. Or their credit report might reflect utility bills that they got behind on. You know, if you're late even twice in a year's time, you can get a black mark on your credit report. It just seems like the more you need it, the more desperately you need it, the less likely you are able to get it. And so these families that are ruled out of the only affordable housing that exists in this country anymore are really left in the flux. You know, there's no safety net. There's nowhere to go. They sometimes will go and stay with a friend until the friend gets a threatening letter from the landlord saying that they're in violation of their lease. We've got a family right now camping in Twin Acres Campground over in Colo in a small pull-behind travel trailer, and this is a family of six. You know, I mean, that's all they can come up with. We have a problem, and part of the problem is the lack of public awareness, and that's why I'm happy you're taking the time to do this.
So you were talking about the only affordable housing programs there are, and that would be Section 8. Is Eastwood Section 8 as well?
It's a different type of Section 8. There's project-based, where you have to live in the landlord's apartments, and then there's voucher-based, where basically you just have to find any landlord and pass an inspection, and it's administered by another type of provider. And we have both in Ames, but there's such a drop in the bucket compared to the need that for most people, they might as well not exist.
There are some people who do qualify for Section 8, and some of them end up in ERP's transitional housing program. They wait for their voucher. Their voucher comes. They have 2 months to use it. And what happens at that point? Do they find such housing in Ames?
It's unlikely they'll find housing in Ames because there's such a small vacancy rate right now. The landlords really don't need to deal with what some would say maybe a high-risk population. These are people that have marginal incomes. They're maybe at most risk of not being able to pay that rent on time every month. And when we had higher vacancy rates of, 6-7% or so, there were enough places sitting empty where landlords, after a month or two, they were willing to take a chance and accept a Section 8 voucher. Right now, I don't know any names that accept them. These are landlords that might be operating up to 2,000 apartments, and yet their place has to be inspected by a person that's licensed by the government to do that. And their claim is, why should I put up with this hassle and maybe even have to make some minor repairs when I can fill it overnight, run an ad, and I'll have 30 people call the following day needing that apartment. So there's no motivation for them to take Section 8.
And then there's another population you help, people who are still in their apartments struggling with all the bills they have to pay, on the edge of homelessness, and you provide funds to get them by. Talk about that population, if you would.
We started that program over 15, maybe close to 20 years ago, simply when we discovered families that were coming to us needing shelter and we didn't have room. At that time, we hadn't built our transitional housing. We didn't even have our basement apartments for families. And I remember discovering they just needed $130, I think, in one case for lot rent, where they're going to lose their home. They own the home, but if you don't pay the lot rent, the landlord can kick you out and keep charging you a lot rent. And so I just called our treasurer one time and said, we don't have this in our budget, but if we could shake loose this much money, we could keep a family in our home. And that seemed like such a good idea that we started doing it, and that became the biggest program that we have. We help more than twice as many people, almost three times, in fact, with what we call homeless prevention. And that's to keep people in their homes by making a payment to their landlord. Usually they're behind at least a month's back rent, sometimes even more, but sometimes the landlord will give them a little bit more slack if we can come up with a few $100 to pay that rent. In some cases, we do that to keep utilities on because if they're in the low-rent housing, it's an automatic eviction if you lose your utilities. I sometimes think that's the best thing we're doing because we can help so many families that way and make a difference by keeping a kid having to switch schools for maybe the third time in the school year, after leaving because of an eviction. So we can provide a little bit better stability for the family. Now, most of the families we help were not the answer to their longer-term need. They need affordable, permanent housing, and we don't offer that. And so all we can do is buy them a little more time, and sometimes that's all they needed. If they had to make a car repair because they had to have the car running to get to work, and we help them towards the rent so they could put the rent money into the repair bill, that sort of thing, well, then sometimes I can feel really good that for, say, $350, we're able to keep a family in their home and not break the ties to neighbors and friends. And we do enough of that to make it well worthwhile, but you can't escape the fact that the majority of the people we help in this program need help every month. They're on such a tight budget that we can help them one time, but if they're already paying more than half their income for housing, they're in an untenable situation that they can't sustain. Nationwide, what we've been finding is that wages haven't kept up with rent costs or housing costs.
Along those lines, I remember you citing some statistic about how much a single mother would have to work to support herself.
Yeah, it's a study done by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. They report information on every county in the United States and larger towns, for instance, Ames is included. And what their data shows is that a single mother working minimum wage has to work 79 hours a week to afford what's called the fair market rent in Ames, which is, I believe, it's $750 a month. And so you can see that it's not even in the ballpark, you know, of being realistic. And yet that's the cold facts of what it takes and what they're up against. The general public is largely oblivious to the problem. If they're experiencing the problem, they certainly know about it. But if they're not, there's no headline news. There's nothing on the TV, you know, that I would bet if you did start researching, you wouldn't find a single media coverage of the number of evictions that are going on in Story County. You know, and to me, that's a bellwether of a community's health, is how many people are reaching the bitter end and losing their homes forcibly.
That was Vic Moss of Emergency Residence Project in Ames. This is Local Talk, and we're discussing the housing crisis in Ames. Well, Greta, that was a pretty sobering account of poverty in our own town. I just feel like a rock is on me when I hear him talk.
When I heard him say that last bit, I felt like the fire was under my butt. Because I hadn't planned on going and talking to the sheriff about the eviction statistics. This show was coming due. I had the deadline coming up, and it was like, uh-oh. I called up the sheriff and asked them if they had statistics on eviction, and the person who answered the phone said, what years would you like? And I said, how about the last 2 years? And she said, okay, we've got the statistics on the writs of possession.
And what is a writ of possession?
Writ.
Writ.
W-R-I-T.
Sounds like the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, it is an old-fashioned word, and Lieutenant Don Ellis does a really good job.
Okay, we'll listen to him.
Essentially, what the writ of possession is a court order that has been issued by a judge to evict a tenant from the property for which they're staying.
Okay, and this occurs after the landlord has communicated multiple times with the tenant about situations that are unacceptable?
Yes, that's correct. Typically, a landlord would contact a tenant for maybe a number of reasons. Maybe it's for failure to pay rent, violations of a lease agreement, stay over after a lease had expired. The landlord would contact these tenants in these situations and give a notice of intent to terminate their lease.
Presumably, that's when a tenant would scramble to fix things, or else, looking at the situation and knowing it couldn't be remedied, some of them might just leave before a writ of possession is served.
Yes, that's correct. And as far as the notice of intent, that could be served by the landlord, the landlord's attorney. It could be served by certified letter or by deputies at the sheriff's office.
Okay, so you can't have exact numbers on that. So what we're looking at, when we look at the numbers for writs of possession, as we are doing, is a minimum estimate of how many evictions have taken place.
Right. Over the last 2 years, the sheriff's office has executed 297 writs of possession.
Okay. So almost 150 per year on average.
Correct. Looking at the data that we have, our busiest months seem to be the first part of the year and then during the first part of summer, which coincides with the semesters at Iowa State University.
So what would happen might be that a student rents a place and might rent it from August 1st to August 1st, but decides in May, when they're done with their coursework, to just split. And that would be a cause for eviction, even though they're gone.
That does happen, correct.
Okay. So some of these are students, and some of them obviously are families. Let's look at some of the numbers. We have October of 2011, there were 12 evictions, and for instance, in April of 2012, there were 13 evictions. So it seems to be around that, unless you get into a month like July, where you might see a lot more student influence, and 18 evictions in that.
That's correct.
How long have you been on the force?
I've been with the sheriff's office just about 16 years.
Have you seen any changes in the eviction patterns or frequencies?
It seems as though when we're having problems with the economy, you tend to notice more writs of possession coming through.
So has it been getting any better, or is it still kind of in a down slump?
I think it's pretty well averaged out. Like the last couple of years, the economy has become better, and by our data, it shows that we pretty much are back to our average numbers of writs.
Are you ever personally involved in these actions?
I've served many writs of possession myself, that's correct.
And what is that experience like?
It can be very disheartening. When you go in to move a family from the residence where you've got small children and the parents have absolutely nowhere to go, it's very disheartening.
Do you know where they do go?
What we attempt to do is try to find housing in some form for these families. We attempt to speak with relatives, with friends, and we try to do our best that we can to help them find a place until they can make permanent arrangements.
Ruination day in the sky was red. I went back to work.
A dozen families a month.
Yeah. That's a lot. Well, like Vic said, it's a symptom of something much greater. One of the things that the activists involved with affordable housing issues in Ames have been looking at is the CDBG, the Community Development Block Grant Program. And that's another one administered by HUD, HUD. It's intended for low to moderate income neighborhoods and individuals. And it's a small pot of money that Ames can tap into to get a few things done. And their proposal for one of these CDBG programs a couple years ago, this was right after the flood, was to tear down a bunch of apartments down there on South 5th Street. These are homes that are low income, affordable rental units.
They don't have a sense of how tight the rental market is.
Right. And so that's when we started to try to collect some data about that fact. And we've had doing this for us, Department of Sociology professor from ISU.
Jan Flora.
Jan Flora, who knows his statistics.
He's involved in another program here, AMIS.
AMIS is an advocacy group for people in poverty very often.
Okay.
So one of the issues that has always come up in house meetings, and these are meetings where we kind of talk to everybody and say, what are the things that are dragging you down? And almost always people say, the housing is so expensive, but, you know, this is Ames, what can we do? And so we've heard, oh, this is Ames, what can we do, for so long that finally the organizers of AMIS decided, you know, people care about this, and there are things that we can do. And so Jan has been involved in AMIS, and in this interview he talks about the statistics he's gathered about the city of Ames and its rental housing stock.
Well, let's listen to Jan Flora.
The way I'd like to start out is by telling you a story rather than throwing a lot of facts at people. When we came to work at Iowa State about 20 years ago, one of the things that I noticed was that all of our secretaries lived in smaller communities outside of Ames because they really couldn't afford to live in Ames. And that idea has stuck with me for quite a while. Ames is kind of a high-rent district. If we look at the cost of rental housing, for instance, Story County is just a little bit below that of Polk County. And probably if we had data specifically on Ames, we would find that Ames actually had higher cost rental housing than metropolitan Des Moines. So we've been looking at some of these questions to see whether the anecdotal ideas actually show up in statistics.
So what kind of things do you look for in the statistics?
Well, there are a number of things that you can look at. One of them is that the Housing and Urban Development Department of the federal government has a standard that says that people should not have to pay more than 30% of their income on housing. And the data that we have with respect to households, and this would be all households in Ames, is that over half of the households actually pay more than 30% of their income on housing. It's clear that more than half of the households in Ames spend too much on their housing. Now, that includes students, so we're going to look more carefully at the non-student households and see what percentage we end up with. But in any case, we're talking about pretty high housing costs in Ames. I think it's kind of one of the side effects of being a university town. I think if you went to other university towns, you'd find a similar issue. That doesn't mean that we equate university towns with only expensive housing. We should be able to figure out, as a populace, as the citizens of Ames, ways that we could have housing of various sizes and prices so that all of the people who work in Ames could afford to live in Ames as well.
Is it a supply and demand kind of issue?
Well, supply and demand is always influenced by other factors than the market. Politics often plays a role. And sometimes in the case of housing, it's a little bit difficult to tease out exactly what that politics is. But in any case, we simply have not built an adequate amount of affordable housing for people other than students. Of course, right now we have record enrollments at Iowa State, so that's putting even greater pressure on the housing market, not just for the students, but for other people who may work here but cannot afford to own their own homes. So one of the amazing statistics about Ames is that normally if you have a fully utilized rental housing market, you would have about 3% vacancy rate in the rental housing. In other words, you have people coming in and leaving, and there needs to be that 3% vacancy in order for people to find housing when they need it. The figure for 2011 for Ames was 1.7% vacancy rate. So that's well below what one would normally expect to have.
So even if people can afford the rental rates that are present in Ames, it's still very difficult to find housing.
Yes, absolutely. The other thing that we're looking at then is to figure out the relationship between the incomes of those people who live in Ames and those people who work in Ames. We sort of need a little lesson in data here, but the census, and we have something now that's called the American Community Survey. We actually have stopped doing a census other than simply the counts that we need in order to determine the numbers of people in order to redistrict our congressional and state legislative districts. We've stopped doing that, so we actually have surveys. And the American Community Survey is our successor to the census with respect to social and economic and housing data. Okay, so that's the census and the American Community Survey base their statistics on where people live, not where they work. But the Bureau of the Census also gathers periodic data every 5 years. There's an economic census, and they determine what the wages are for people who work. And they use the places of employment as the source of data. So that provides us with information about the incomes of those people who work in Ames, where the census and its successor tell us about the incomes of people who live in Ames. And what we find, at least what we found in the preliminary analysis, is that there's close to a $20,000 difference in earned income between those two groups. That is, the people who live in Ames have much higher incomes than the people who work in Ames. Now, obviously, some people both live and work in Ames, so if we could separate them out, we would see that an awful lot of the people who work in the low-wage jobs are people who cannot afford to live in Ames.
That's just what your anecdote told us, that the secretaries in your department were not able to live here in Ames.
And a lot of the retail jobs, working at McDonald's or at Walmart and so forth, are much lower wage jobs than that. So many of the people who work in those kinds of jobs, number one, either can't afford to live in Ames, or they have to have more than one job. You may have seen the news, the national news, in which McDonald's actually had on their website a budget for their workers. And that budget included having a second job in order to make ends meet.
In addition to working full-time at McDonald's?
In addition to working full-time at McDonald's.
That was Jan Flora, recently retired from the Department of Sociology at ISU. You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're talking about affordable housing in Ames.
Okay, so I've heard about this McDonald's budget. I saw a piece done that on the Colbert Report, actually. So there were protests going on about people who worked in fast food restaurants saying they want a living wage.
They do.
And so McDonald's had an answer for this. They did not want to raise their wages. They put up a website of how to budget your income so you can get by on this $7.25. I was very surprised that they did not include heat as part of their budget.
But they did have a line item for heat.
They did.
It was just zero.
Everyone who works at McDonald's must live in Arizona.
What you do when you can't pay your rent? Where you go when you don't have a cent? Tell me. What you do when you can't pay your rent? Where you go when you don't have a cent? You tell me.
The most likely thing that's happening in communities that are growing is that they're actually depleting their affordable housing. New developments go into where the property is the cheapest. They go into where trailer courts are sitting because it turns out the land is worth more than the trailers. And that's what's happened in Ames. We've torn down one after another. More than half in the last 15 years have disappeared in Ames, where hundreds and hundreds of families could once live. And these were the places that families used to go once they left our shelter. You know, with a mobile home, if they got even a minimum wage job, they could sometimes afford that, you know, and stay there. And I felt really good about that. But there's a huge lack of affordable housing, and there's nothing on the drawing boards anywhere.
Have you spoken with either public officials in Ames or developers about these trends toward tearing down low-income housing and replacing it with high-end housing?
Yeah, I have. Both myself and others, we've talked to the mayor, to most of the city council, and hopefully to all the new ones. And as far as developers, we've got one developer that's made part of what we have possible. You know, they've actually tried to do what to make housing as cheaply as they could in Ames. It's actually a guy named Al Christie, but he looked at, it's called a Kansas-style home, and I think it's somewhere like maybe 1,100 square feet. For new homes, this would be on the small size with, I think, unfinished basements. I don't remember if it had garages, but, and then they went on the private market, and almost immediately they were hugely expensive, way beyond what a family making minimum wage could afford because there's so much demand for housing. Especially if you're close to the campus, you could rent anything and make pretty good money. And so that's kind of the problem that we have is that we're dealing, in Ames anyway, dealing with a student population, which does inflate the housing market.
So many people with nowhere to go. Little children sleeping on the floor. People walking around with nothing to eat. A little boy running around with no shoes on his feet. Nowhere to go. What we gonna do? What would you do if it happened to you?
That song is by Jimmy McMillan, a guy who ran for mayor in New York City. His party was actually named the Rent is Too Damn High Party. So that brings up another major part of our story. And the big elephant in the room is Iowa State University. And the president of the university, Stephen Leith's ambition to grow and grow the university, I'm not sure the president has given much thought to the housing of students, but I know that the director of residence, Pete Englund, has. And he's been scrambling to find students places to sleep. The students last year, the extra students, were housed in the dormitory lounges. And certainly we all thought, oh, this is a temporary solution. They'll find another way.
And?
Well, Pete did say that there'll be some students back in the lounges this year, but there are more actions going on, including a rather interesting solution of ISU leasing up two entire apartment buildings as residence halls. So everyone who was living there had to decide whether they wanted to live in an apartment building that had just turned into a residence hall, or whether they would rather live independently in an apartment building. And if so, they would have to move. That's what was happening in the Legends building right there on Stanton. They had to change, definitely, if they were going to call it student housing, they were going to have to change the atmosphere of that building, and they were going to have to put residence hall people in there. So that's one apartment building they rented, and then there was another one, a new one, built by Dixon Jensen, which is Dean Jensen's brother, over south of the middle school, the new middle school. So there are some apartment buildings right across from the middle school, and these would be further down the way on that side of the road. Honestly, most of those apartments were built for students. So you have a four-bedroom apartment with four bathrooms. It's pretty much built for students, not for a family. Because family members, you know, you can wait for each other to go to the bathroom. But so that was one of their solutions. And then they are building, as people might have noticed, a set of apartment buildings down on 13th Street near Stang. And that's what they call a stick building.
I heard him say stick building. What does that mean?
A stick building means it's not like a big, huge brick dorm. A regular crew of framers go in and frame the structure with 2x4s, maybe some 2x6s. They slap on some siding, they slap on some wallboard, and they're done. So here's Pete Englund talking about all those changes.
The use of the den spaces was a kind of a historical remedy that was used in the 80s. When there was really tremendous growth that could exceed what any building could happen. You typically are on a 2 or 3 year schedule if you look to build. And so you're also trying to do something that you can sustain. Many people remember in 2000, 2001, we had two large bubble classes come through, large freshman classes. A lot of gearing up occurred for that, and then we saw a drop off following that. So you don't want to overbuild and overextend yourself. You want it to be sustained. So we have gone back to still utilizing dens. That occurred in conversation with student leaders. Do you want us to tell people no? And they said, no, we'd rather not. We think you really do have students' best interests at heart. Try and find a way to accommodate them. It means you lose your common space. They said, we'll work with that. Is it possible you could give those back to us at no later than semester break? We believe so. The second thing we've done is we realized we could build some on-campus apartments, Frederickson units, and cash flow those units with the students that would live there at the existing rates. So they're stick built, they're less expensive to build, and so we move forward with a proposal to the Board of Regents and appreciate their support to build another 720 beds where we don't have to change rates for anybody. It just provides extra capacity on campus, but it is a different kind of experience than the residence hall space. For our traditional aid students, we really want them to build connections with each other, connections to this new learning experience. We like them to be close to campus where they can walk to classes. And so that's where we like our traditional age, new to ISU students to live, is in our residence halls. And then the other part is we like the fact that our upper class tend to stay in our residence halls. They help teach our new students what it means to be successful at Iowa State. We don't want freshmen teaching freshmen what it means to be a student. We like to have sophomores and juniors being the ones that are assisting us through their leadership on the floors. And so that's really part of the magic, and we think why right now students are seeking us out in higher numbers than we previously experienced.
Before we get to the non-conventional strategy that you have adopted, the renting up of two private apartment buildings, I understand that the President, Stephen Leith, has ambitions for ISU to continue to grow. I don't know what his end point is, but are you concerned about a bubble, or are you planning long range for more housing on campus?
Well, it doesn't hurt for us to think forward about possibilities. If we continue to see the kind of growth and enrollment or experience consistent enrollment like this, we need to provide more housing on campus.
No. Now, we have heard from the Ames Tribune that there were some students who were evicted from the Legends Building or Legacy Apartments. What was that about?
At the time that we got the offer from American Campus Communities, they indicated in their 1,200-bed inventory that they had plenty of space to relocate students. Nobody was what I would call evicted. It would be we have equal to or better space already within our inventory, and some of that was Kitty Corner. We're at 119 Stanton. At 200 Stanton, they own that building, and they owned another 600-700 beds going to the south there. And so what we agreed to do, I said, you know, there is going to be inconvenience to students. We did a price match of a total of $30,000 that would be applied to students to compensate them for any inconvenience, and that they would get to move into equal to or better housing that was already within their inventory. But in that process, literally we're talking, you know, 3 to 5 days from the time we get the logistics kind of worked out. I'm aware of 9 students who contacted our office frustrated with what took place. I think we were able to serve 8 of those eventually well through conversation about what they wanted and where they wanted to be. To have one family feeling hurt, feeling like Iowa State didn't care, for us, one is too many. We never want anybody to feel like they did. We were learning in some ways as we went along. You know, in retrospect, we would have done it differently sooner. You know, if we could have made this decision last fall, it would have been a lot simpler. We were faced with 1,200 students that we would have been disappointing in saying no to, between dens, which aren't ideal, being able to get 240 Frederickson beds online, that was helpful. We are still 500 to 700 short. In the big picture, we're happy with the outcome. We never want anybody to feel like they did about Iowa State or us serving them, but it happened. This past spring, with the recontracting rates up over 8%, that surprised us. We thought using dens, high occupancy, we thought fewer students would probably choose to live with us and that they would then move off and it would create some capacity. Our return rates went up and our new student enrollment and interest in on-campus housing went up. It was kind of a perfect storm.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That was Pete Englund of ISU's Department of Residence. From his point of view, it's not just the student enrollments that are going up. It's the number of students or the percentage of students who want to live on campus.
He had a lot to deal with.
From our perspective, looking at housing for families in Ames, whether the students decide to live on campus or off campus, there's pressure. There's increasing pressure on the housing market. But this affects everybody. And so businesses, both the businesses who are long established in our community and businesses who want to locate here, are running into this housing obstacle. I went down to the Chamber of Commerce and spoke with Vice President Ron Hallenbeck.
Well, I'm basically, you know, on the economic development side, you know, part of the chamber. My main role, it has to do with really working with our existing businesses, businesses of all size, but obviously I do work with a lot of our larger ones. I have roughly about 50 major companies, you know, here in Ames who I deal with and keep track of. And my whole role really is to make sure that we can keep them happy within our community and help them, you know, hopefully expand their operations as, you know, the business opportunity presents itself to them. As I go out and talk to the businesses, and I do that, you know, quite often, what we're hearing from them is that, you know, they have great desire to expand their businesses. And the one thing that they look at is what is that workforce and where is that workforce going to live? More and more what I'm hearing them say is that Ames, as we know, is a great community. And we like the workers to be able to live here. We know that not all of them are going to be here. But we do need housing going from the very affordable up to people who would like some larger homes. We are attracting people from outside of the Ames area to bring in some special skills that these companies want. And they may be coming from large metropolitan areas. And, you know, they have a housing need in their mind, which is a little different sometime than what we have available right now. What we hear from the companies coming in from out of town is if they're going to come and they want to develop their business right here in Ames, they want their employees here in Ames. They don't necessarily want them living down in Ankeny or Des Moines, which some always will, but that we have got the available housing here, again, throughout the spectrum, low to, you know, more expensive. And they're saying that they're finding it harder and harder that we have enough housing of all different kinds.
When you say that businesses might draw people from more urban settings and they come here looking for something, what are you talking about, really? What kind of housing are they interested in?
They could be coming from anywhere within the U.S., larger metropolitan areas. It could be a Chicago. It could be, you know, from out east or California, Washington State. Some of them are looking for large lots that could be an acre, could be a half an acre. They usually don't find those readily available right here in Ames. They have to go more out of Ames itself, but that's not necessarily where they want to go. When they're coming to this area, they're typically used to a lot of, you know, amenities being close in. And we just don't have those type of lots. Now, that is not saying that everyone wants those type, but we're getting more and more people who are interested in them because we're bringing some professionals, again, from outside of the area who may have been in an industry and are seeing the opportunity to move to a different community.
Stephanie, did you hear how I messed up that interview?
How did you mess it up?
Well, I mean, it's certainly useful to know that there's a shortage of housing of all kinds in Ames, as Ron was saying. I mean, that's an interesting perspective. It's not just low-income housing. It's housing of all types. But then I heard him say that thing about the businesses wanting to attract specialists from out of town, and I was sucked in. I wanted to know what these urban sophisticates wanted. You know, I asked that question. And then
he started talking about one-acre lots.
Yeah, one-acre lots. Totally floored me because from my perspective, that's all they're building in Ames. And so I didn't know we lacked those. And, you know, evidently we do. But the fact that the conversation went that way was due to my curiosity about that elite population.
You got caught up in the glamour.
Yes, I got caught up in the glamour.
And that's easy to do. I think you're right.
And I think that happens a lot here because there are so many interesting people in Ames doing really interesting things, and it's really not as glamorous to think about how we are going to house the working poor.
And the housing itself is not glamorous for the working poor.
I mean, there is an organization, Architecture for Humanity, that really focuses on coming up with new, interesting designs for marginal populations, like refugees even.
Or ways to cut down on costs with solar panels and structure of housing to make it more efficient.
Right. I think, you know, when we think low-income housing, we're thinking inside of a box, and that box is not attractive. And we'd rather think about the more glamorous places where we don't have a box and we're free to design something cool and interesting.
Right. But it is true that you can design something cool and interesting for affordable housing.
I think it is. I think it is true. But anyway, I did my best to follow up on that interview. So let's hear that part.
We've had some companies talk about, you know, they would like to have, you know, transportation, you know, opportunities for workers who don't even live here in Ames. You know, with SciRide here in town, that's a great opportunity for people. But SciRide doesn't necessarily always hit all of the industry areas that we have, for example, over in the Bell Avenue.
So better transportation, expanding SciRide routes to the South Dayton area is one solution. Any others?
We're going to actually talk about solutions in the next show. So I'm looking forward to seeing what our new planning and housing director, Kelly Diekman, has to say about some of the solutions and maybe some of the collaborative efforts that could take place between the university and the city and nonprofit agencies like ERP or Story County Community Housing, which builds low-income housing, or Habitat for Humanity, and possibly even the Chamber of Commerce. And then there's always Vic to motivate us.
The Old Testament prophet from Ames.
Yep. Here's Vic.
There are no simple solutions, but there are solutions. Unless we're willing to buckle down and take the courageous steps and try to educate, you know, our family and friends and club members and everybody we have contact with that there is a problem. And you don't have to be a social scientist to understand it. Just look at the income and figure out how much you would pay for rent. We've had some people that have really wanted to change this and make it better. You know, we've had some council members on our board over the years, and they were simply helpless because there wasn't the public support to hold them up. The solutions all take money. I can't find anything that's going to be easy. And yet, if we don't deal with the problem, well, then we're going to have to just acknowledge that we're willing to tolerate children living without homes. You know, it's certainly against the law to abuse your children physically, and yet when you don't offer even a possibility of a family having a roof over their heads, that child is being just as surely abused. It's happening because of the larger society being unknowledgeable or unwilling, you know, to do what it takes to do to make sure there's a roof over their head.
And we're not talking about complete strangers. The public of our communities do interact with some of the people who are in pain and struggling for housing. They're performing retail jobs. They're serving food and taking out our garbage. So these are our members of our community.
That's right. One of my thoughts is that every community should simply have it etched in stone if necessary, so don't forget it, that the range of housing in their community should reflect the range of incomes, so that people, if they're good enough to work here, they're good enough to live here. And the answer isn't shipping them off or forcing them out to have to drive 20, 30 miles with the cost of gasoline. It's hard to say if they're even coming out ahead. And then when the car breaks down, that can be the end of a job, and we've seen that happen.
I'm going down this road feeling bad. I'm going down this road feeling bad. I'm going down this road feeling bad, bad, bad. And I ain't gonna be treated this way.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Stephanie Schubert. Greta did the reporting for the show.
Stephanie helped edit the interviews and provided other valuable production assistance. Thanks for coming with me on this journey, Stephanie.
Thank you, Greta. This is an important issue, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
As always, Richard Morrison is the one who actually got the show to your radio.
Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Kate Shelley was actually a local person from Boone County. We have a show about her on our website, khoifm.org.
It's there with our other shows, including this one. You'll find the names of our guests and contact information.
Local Talk is a radio training workshop as well as a show. You are most welcome to join us.
And thank you for joining us today.
I live in Huxley, which is the third move in the last 3 years.
So where else have you lived?
Garden City. It was what was affordable when my wife, when she was alive and we had four children to support. Garden City was affordable. Ames was not. And it's still not today for me.
But you have a full-time job.
I have a very good job, a full-time job. I've been there 12 years. I get a fair pay. I think it's a good pay for this area. But I am a single parent with one income in my household. And honestly, I can't keep up in Ames financially.
And I ain't gonna be treated this way, Lord God, I ain't gonna be treated this way.